Welcome to the bike show with me, Jack Thurston. It's well over 100 days since the coronavirus lockdown was introduced here in the UK. But as we appear to have passed through the peak of the epidemic, or the first wave anyway, many of the restrictions on travel are being lifted and relaxed. And with summer here, I'm struggling to think of a better summer holiday, a better way to get a change of scene after all those months stuck at home, than by heading out on your bike to explore the country where you live. So this episode of The Bike Show is all about cycle touring, cycle exploring, bike packing, adventure cycling, or whatever term you like to use to describe the act of heading out into the world on your bike for a few days, a week, or even longer. And joining me down the line from Charlbury in Oxfordshire, where he lives, is Richard Fairhurst. And Richard is a bit of a 21st century Renaissance man. He is a cartographer and a software developer. He's been a magazine editor and was an early pioneer with OpenStreetMap. In his spare time, he volunteers as a Sustrans ranger and is chair of his local town council. And as well as all that, he's a dad, a cyclist, a canal boater, and a player of church organs. And I owe a special debt of gratitude to Richard because it's his luscious cartography that graces the map pages of my Lost Lanes books. But the real reason I wanted Richard to come on the podcast is because he runs a brilliant website called cycle.travel. It's a combination of an interactive map with powerful routing and navigation tools and a series of really well-written and researched guides to multi-day touring routes, mostly in the UK, but also in France, and there's one route I see in New Zealand. As you might expect from a couple of cycle touring obsessives, Richard and I talk for quite a long time, so this is an extended podcast. And for the first half of our chat, we talk about some of our favourite long-distance routes in the UK. And in the second half, we really start geeking out about how to plan a journey and what to take. Sandwiched between our conversations is another perspective altogether from a friend of mine, Josie Parkinson, here in Abergavenny, reflecting on her first ever multi-day cycle tour. My interview with Josie comes at about the 42-minute mark, so if you want to scrub ahead to that, feel free. This is a podcast you may want to listen to in more than one sitting. I began my chat with Richard by asking him whether he agreed with me that cycling is the perfect summer holiday in a global pandemic.
Absolutely. It's something about the pace of travel. You see more than you would on a walking holiday, but you see it in much more detail than you would on a car holiday. You really get to feel the countryside that you're travelling through. And everything I have learned about Britain, I would say, I have learned from the saddle of a bike.
It's also an activity that takes place necessarily outdoors, so you don't have to worry about being in confined spaces with people. You're usually pretty well self-isolated out on a bicycle in the countryside. And if you take it to the next step and go cycle camping, you really needn't come into contact with anyone.
Indeed. And it's been quite nice watching the cyclists go past. I live on the edge of the Cotswolds and it's quite popular cycling country. Throughout lockdown, we've seen loads of cyclists, people doing their daily exercise on the local lanes. But I've really noticed over the past week, all of a sudden, the panniers are coming out again. People are starting to go for longer trips on their bikes. Sometimes you'll see a tent rather tentatively strapped to the panniers. Sometimes people seem to be just going on a longer ride to friends or whatever. But yes, I think people are itching to get out there again.
And have you noticed an uptick in traffic on your website, cycle.travel, as people plan their trips?
I have, absolutely. When the lockdown started, the traffic just went through the floor. No one was looking at us anymore. No one was planning bike rides. I thought, this is it. This is all stopped now. Actually, over the past month, I think the traffic to the website has been higher than it ever has been. And it seems to be going up every week. People are looking for something to do, which is, as you say, outdoors, healthy, not going to put them too much at risk. But also, I think people have got more of a maybe more of an appreciation of staying at home. Flying is out for several reasons for lots of people at the moment. It is not clear whether or not we would be welcomed if we went overseas. So let's have a domestic holiday, a staycation, as people call it these days. And yes, what better way to do that than on a bike?
And it's also pretty easy on the wallet, isn't it? Cycle touring. You can go the full gourmet restaurants and hotels experience, but you can do it pretty cheaply if you want to.
You can, yes. You can take a tent and just pile up at a pub which has got a garden where they're prepared to let you sleep. Or conversely, you can do the whole credit card touring thing, find B&Bs overnight, even cheap hotels, travel lodges, that sort of thing. I'm not one of these people who wants to get particularly prescriptive about it's only cycle touring if you do it with a tent, or it's only cycle touring if you do it on a steel bike, or whatever it might be. The art of cycle touring is going out there, enjoying the countryside, and whatever you do over and above that is up to you.
So we'll talk about the routing and navigational tools on cycle.travel a bit later on, but I want to start in a place which I think is actually quite an overlooked area of your website, which is the route guides that you've designed. And as someone who writes books with route guides for primarily day rides, although some of my Lost Lanes routes you can kind of stitch together into multi-day tours, where you have done some great work is in writing up multi-day linear routes, essentially, on the website. Sometimes doing, especially if you're going for the first time on a multi-day journey, it's quite nice to follow a sort of set itinerary, or you at least use that as your framework and kind of improvise along the way. But it's nice to have that to fall back on. And the guides that you've got there are really good. And a good place to start for people, if you're going to take a look at the website, is on the interactive map of the various long distance itineraries. And we're really talking about the UK here. And you've got routes going the length and breadth of the United Kingdom.
Yes, definitely. And this is something I did because I'd started exploring these routes for myself. My curiosity had been piqued about 15 years ago, seeing these blue signs with these mysterious numbers on them, pointing to places. Well, that looks like a cycle route. I'm not quite sure which way it goes. Finding out information about them was quite hard. And so I got into finding out about the National Cycle Network, finding out about what Sustrans does. And the first route I did was Llanlas Cymru, which is the national route through Wales from Cardiff up to Holyhead. And basically, at that point, I was hooked. I thought this is a really fascinating thing to do. You get to see some great countryside. Someone has chosen, hopefully, and we can get into this later, but someone has hopefully chosen a good route for you. I just loved it. And I thought, okay, well, if I'm enjoying this, other people will enjoy it. But there doesn't seem to be much written about it. There's not much on the web. There aren't that many guidebooks. So maybe I've got an opportunity to write about something here.
I think what we should do is dive right in, and we can each of us pick out some of our favourite routes that appear on your website, and if I can think of any that don't appear, we can maybe talk about those as well. So do you want to go first? And maybe we should talk about Llanlas Cymru, because that's that's one of my favorite routes, and it's the one that got you into doing these long distance route guides.
Yes, and I think it's still one of the finest cycle routes that there is in Britain. So Llanlas Cymru is the Welsh National Cycle Route. It's National Cycle Network route number 8, and it starts at Cardiff, or alternate start at Chepstow if you like, and it goes the length of Wales up to Holyhead. It's mostly on quiet lanes and occasional traffic-free trails. In particular, the bit through the South Wales valleys follows a route called the Taff Trail from Cardiff to Brecon, and that's mostly traffic-free, old canal towpaths, old railway paths, that sort of thing. When you get into the glorious countryside of Mid Wales into Powys, then you have got tiny little lanes, and some of them are beautifully well chosen. Some of my favourite lanes anywhere in Britain are on this route. And then, of course, you get to Snowdonia, and as soon as you get to Snowdonia, you can't avoid the hills. So it's not a trivial route. People say it is the most difficult route on the National Cycle Network, and it might be, but it is so rewarding. It's very varied. It's mostly pretty quiet. You will not see a bunch of cars for the great majority of it, and it's very varied. You will see the coast. You will see the city of Cardiff, of course. You will see market towns such as Brecon and lovely little places like Machynlleth. And the way that the countryside changes imperceptibly but slowly from the valleys to the Brecon Beacons to Snowdonia to Anglesey, it changes with you and it will tire you out. It is not an easy route, but it is enormous amounts of fun. And I want to do it again sometime soon.
So that's 250 miles. What would you think would be a reasonable amount of time to do? I mean, that's a bit of a how long is a piece of string question. But what's your kind of rule of thumb for a day's travel on the bike in terrain like Wales?
So I did that in 4 days. I think if I were to go and do it again, I would probably spend a bit more time over it, probably take it to 5 days. The one thing that always gets me, and I've heard other people say that it throws them as well, is that you say, okay, I can do 40, 50, 60 miles a day, whatever it might be. And yeah, maybe you can. Maybe that's what you do with your day rides. That's fine. But day two, day three on a bike, it always hurts when you get on the saddle. And by 3 miles in, you're thinking, I can't possibly do this. So it's not just about how many miles can you do a day. It's about easing yourself in, making sure that you don't start the day with an absolutely beastly climb, because that will wipe you out for the whole rest of the day. And also, really obvious point, don't forget to factor in your travel time back and forth. So although I say it took me 4 days, I made sure that I arrived at Cardiff the night before, stayed in a youth hostel. I made sure that I left on the very last train out of Holyhead that night, because if I was going to try and cram the travel back and forth into the 4 days, then in reality, I'd be doing 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, there is another advantage of this route, and this is something that doesn't apply to all long distance routes, is that there's a pretty good direct train from Holyhead to Cardiff that you can take in either direction.
Yes, yeah. And it's one of the questions that I get asked at Cycle Travel, and that is, it's a very difficult question to answer, which is, how do I get to the start or end of a route by train? And that is challenging, because there are 20 different train companies in Britain. Each of them runs 5 or 10 different types of trains, and each type of train has its own rules about how you book, how many bikes it can carry, and so on and so forth. So when I can, in the cycle travel route guides, I always try to have a little section saying, how can you get to the start and the end, and maybe points along the way, because it's not obvious. You know, Great Western have just changed their entire train fleet for new ones, which have got completely different bike carriage arrangements. You have to work out these things if you can do the ride.
A little bit of local knowledge, because I live in Wales, and there is a train that goes once in each direction called the Gerald of Wales. And that's a kind of a train that is run or subsidised by the Welsh government. I think it's ostensibly to provide a way for politicians and other policymakers from the north of Wales who live up there to get down to the seat of national government in Cardiff in the morning and back again at the end of the day. And that train has a particular rolling stock, which has a dining car where you can have a you know, waiter service and a delicious meal and wine and all the rest of it as you go. I'm not sure if it's operating like that in these COVID times, but it's also, more importantly and more relevantly for cyclists, got a guards van, which means that they're a little bit more accommodating and it's a little bit less stressful to get your bike on the train, on that train, than it is on the usual trains where you're competing for a couple of bike storage spaces with people who've got enormous suitcases and push chairs and prams and all the rest of it. That can be a little bit stressful, that even if you've got a bike reservation, you feel like, oh gosh, this family, I've got to unseat this family from where they are. And it just feels, makes you feel a bit awkward. And I would think it would, yeah, it's not something that's nice to have to do. So a guards van is great if it's available.
I have memories of having loaded my bike onto, in fact, a train coming through Abergavenny once, and the nominal bike space was full of people's suitcases from Manchester Airport, because that's where the train had started. So my bike ended up balancing rather gingerly on top of people's suitcases. I don't think I deposited too much oil on them, but you can never quite tell.
Well, let's hop across the Bristol Channel to Devon for my choice, which is the Devon Coast to Coast. And this is a brilliant route. I mean, we think of coast-to-coast routes as being in the north of England, and we'll probably come to some of those later on in our chat. But the Devon coast-to-coast is every bit the equal of the northern coast-to-coasts. It starts at Ilfracombe on the north coast, or you can start it a little bit further south in Barnstable, where there is a railway station, and crosses Devon, which is England's second largest county and one of its most varied counties in terms of scenery, with two coasts and an area of upland, Dartmoor in the middle. And it uses three railway lines to make that journey easier than it otherwise would be. It begins on the Tarka Trail in the north of the county, along the River Torridge, isn't it?
Yes.
Through the landscape, which was inspiration for Henry Williamson's writing Tarka the Otter. And then you go onto a little bit of lanes, and then you're suddenly in Okehampton and onto the Granite Way, which is an old railway line that goes through really the highest country in, or to the very edge of the highest country in Dartmoor, and crosses a couple of breathtaking railway viaducts that are real highlights of the route. And then you have another little bit back onto the lanes, and you pick up another railway line that takes you down to Plymouth from Tavistock. And I think it's the most family-friendly long-distance route in the country that I can think of.
Absolutely. It is a brilliant route. It's a great route to ride. And I like it as well for what it represents. It represents the local council taking leisure cycling seriously. They have invested a lot of money into the wonderful Gem Bridge, which takes you across a valley where you used to just have to scramble up one side and down the other on a gravel path. And also it shows that cycle touring is really valuable to the local economy. There are cafes and campsites along the full length of it, which clearly get a lot of custom from people riding the Devon coast to coast. So that's something which we don't see so much of in Britain. Cycle touring is sort of viewed as something that happens, but we don't really talk about it. Whereas in France, in large parts of Europe, they really invest in long distance cycle routes. They invest in the Loire and the Rhine and the Danube, you know, all of these magnificent routes. It's a big priority for local government. Here, we're almost slightly ashamed of it. And the Devon C2C, I think, is a good example of local councils taking it seriously, investing in it and making a great route out of the end of it.
So in terms of time, I did that route with my family and another family a couple of years ago. In fact, there's an episode of The Bike Show where we talk about it. And I think we did it in 4 days with about 25 mile days. And the kids were so young that they were actually on the bikes rather than cycling their own bikes because they were all four or under. But now my kids are 7 and 5. I would consider doing it again, and they would be able to ride quite significant chunks of it, definitely more than half of the distance on traffic-free trails. And that's just a great experience for a child to go somewhere under their own steam. And actually, it makes the act of being on holiday with kids, which can actually be sometimes more stressful and wearing than being at home with them. It sort of makes it really easy because you've kind of got constant change, you've got constant stimulation, you've got places where you can stop off, and you know, you just have to build that into your itinerary and your ambition for the day. You're not really going to do more than about 3 or 4 hours of cycling in a day, maybe over two sections if you're with young children, sort of under 10s, I think. And that actually slows you down and allows you to take the foot off the gas, which has all kinds of benefits. And it's something that is a little bit hard to do when you're, you know, just riding with yourself. Once you get your head into the fact that you're not going to be travelling 100 miles that day, it's actually very liberating.
Yes, very much. And of course, the Devon C2C is a good route for that because none of the gradients are too punishing, so that it's the sort of ride that you can do, you know, if you've got a tag along on the back, or if you've got a bike with a bike seat on it for the kid, or whatever it might be. And we're wondering about this right now. We have a little 4-year-old who just has his first tag along, and I'm thinking, OK, well, where can we take him for his first bike tour? I think the Devon C2C is a good candidate. Bits of the Kennet and Avon are good as well, and the North Wales coast actually is a route which has some, it's not complete, but it has some very good long traffic free sections, and I think you can make a good family cycle tour out of that one.
Yeah, all of the railway and canal routes are pretty good for young children. I mean, up in the South Pennines, the canals are brilliant. They really kind of make light work of travelling around that part of the country. And you've got the Leeds and Liverpool Canal, which is sort of variable in terms of the quality but of the surface. But the section nearer Leeds is a pretty good surface. The closer you get to Liverpool, the more sketchy it gets. Any other picks of yours while we're on the subject of family riding and traffic-free long-distance trails in the UK? Because it's something we sort of lack if you compare to France, where they've got, you know, mile after mile of traffic-free trails.
We do, yes. And I think the Peak District is a good place to look for that. You've got the Tissington Trail, you've got the High Peak Trail, and there's the emerging Monsal Trail. I call it emerging because it's got a bit of a gap in the middle of it at the moment. But that's a network of trails which I think you could make a good family cycling holiday out of. Something that I've been looking at recently is what the longest majority traffic-free route you could actually plan in England is. So, you know, let's set ourselves the challenge of having something which is, say, 80% traffic-free and covers a good swathe of territory. And actually, I've managed to plan out a route that would go through the Peak District, starts on the south coast, ends up in Southport near Liverpool. And using canal towpaths, railway trails, that sort of thing, you can get up to 340 miles, which is 80% traffic-free, 20% on road. So at that sort of point, I think, you know, you're starting to say, okay, well, with a bit of investment, a bit of thought, we could maybe start to aspire to having some of these great trails, as you say, as they do in Europe. But as a country, I don't think we're quite there yet.
Well, let's go from relatively easy, family-friendly bike routes to the big one, which is the end-to-end, the Land's End to John O'Groats, which is a popular route for many reasons. I mean, it's the longest long-distance route in the country. And I don't know, it's just got a long history of record breakers and cycle tourists, and it's just something that you probably have to do at one time in your life if you're a cyclist living in the UK. I have to say, I have not done the end-to-end. I hold my hands up. It's something that I've not managed to do yet. But you have a completely different end-to-end route. Well, not completely different, but substantially different end-to-end from the traditional one. Talk us through your critique of the traditional end-to-end routes and why you came up with a new one and what's good about yours.
Okay, so the traditional ones are more or less about getting the mileage done. So Land's End to John O'Groats is 1,000 miles, and usually the route that people take will go through Cornwall and Devon, which are hilly, you can't avoid that, up the Welsh borders, then snake through Warrington, Wigan, that sort of area, usually not very satisfactory route through there, then up across Shap, up to Glasgow and up from there. And, you know, that's fine if you're treating this as an athletic endeavour. If you're treating it as, you know, this is something I want to get the Strava miles for, or I just want to be able to say that I've done it, and good luck to you if that's the sort of cycling that you enjoy. But if I'm spending 2 or 3 weeks on a bike, I want to enjoy it, and I want to enjoy the cycling, I want to enjoy the places I go through. I don't want to rush it. I want it to be a holiday. And so my thought with planning a Land's End to John O'Groats route is, let's have something which isn't all about the endurance, it isn't all about the mileage, it's about having a good time, seeing places on the way, not making it any more difficult than it has to. So I started plotting out a route which would use quiet roads and off-road routes where possible, which would absolutely minimise the elevation and which would try and go through some interesting places. So, you know, that includes a handful of cities such as Gloucester, York, Newcastle, that sort of thing. It uses National Cycle Network routes where they are appropriate, but it doesn't stick to them slavishly as, for example, the Sustrans end-to-end route does. I think the result is something which is an enjoyable holiday route rather than just an endurance route. It's up on Cycle Travel as, I've called it, the easy East Coaster, because it is easier than pretty much all the other routes out there, and it more or less follows the East Coast. And there are people out there doing it. It is an enjoyable route, and I'm always very, very aware with anything on cycle travel. I want people to come back to me and say, thank you, that was a good ride, I enjoyed it. Not, you sent me along a lethal road, I'm never going to use your website again, I had a rubbish holiday. I don't want to ruin anyone's holiday. So this is a route which I enjoy, which I think anyone will enjoy if they're more about seeing things and enjoying the ride.
From Bristol or Gloucester, say, is where you cut eastwards through the Midlands and then emerge into the old coach road, a very historic way from London to York, yes. And up through York, and then through, you go through County Durham to Newcastle, and then you follow the Northumberland coast up to the Scottish border. And I have to put a word in for that section, which is, I think, called Coast and Castles in the sort of Sustrans terminology, and that is a tremendous route. It's another one I think would be a candidate for a good family ride, maybe if the kids are a little bit older, because it's a little bit more on road, but it's fairly flat, desperately beautiful. I mean, huge empty beaches, lovely little fishing villages, some great castles along the way there, and it gets a little bit hillier and wilder the further north you go. But it's a great one, and it's another one with a good train return.
It is. Anna, my wife, is my fiercest critic when it comes to bike routes, and Coast and Castles is her favourite that we've done together of all time. We don't speak so much about Carmarthenshire and Pembrokeshire. That was a bit more of a rocky occasion. But Coast and Castles, she loved them for good reason.
So going from Edinburgh, so you're over the Forth Bridge. Can you cycle over the Forth Bridge?
The old one is basically now for cyclists, buses and walkers. So because there's a new crossing. So, yeah.
And so what happens north of Edinburgh to get you to John O'Groats, and how does that differ from the more recognised end-to-end route?
So there's only a few ways through Scotland, effectively, because pretty much everything gets corralled into a number of valleys. What I've tried to do here is minimise the climbing, but that means that, you know, you're going to go via Pitlochry, you're going to go over pass, you're going to go up through Inverness, but then, you know, try and do a little bit of clinging to the coast for a while before going up towards the Kraskin and then over the top. Something I'm slightly nervous about with any cycle route through the Highlands at the moment is that there is this enormously successful thing which you will know about called the North Coast 500, which is not ostensibly a cycle route. It's a leisure route which people do in on motorbikes and motor caravans, and, you know, sometimes on bikes as well. That has significantly increased the traffic, especially on the North Coast itself. And so I don't think there is necessarily a way to John O'Groats which is as traffic-free as I would ideally like it to be, but this is as traffic-free as it's going to get. And so you've got some beautiful roads up there, say, going past the Kraskin, heading off on the, I think it's the B984, which turns off just past there, then going on the coast until you get to John O'Groats. So 873, so I'm getting my numbers wrong, 873.
And how about the alternative, which is to go up to Cape Wrath? There was recently a bit of publicity about the Cape Wrath Fellowship, which is a long-standing thing in cycling that's sort of been revived recently by Cycling UK, and Pannier.cc did a feature on it. And so that's going up to the other sort of northern corner, the northwest corner of Scotland, with a quite an extended off-road bit at the end. Have you done that?
I haven't, no. I would like to. I'm quite fascinated. I think you touched in a recent interview on the new concept, or the new branding rather, of gravel bikes and bike packing, and to what extent this is different from hybrids and bike touring. And it's interesting seeing the way that this is now trendy, and that people are looking at gravel bike friendly routes. So Cycling UK have done the Great North Trail, which extends the Pennine Bridleway up to Cape Wrath, and they're playing around with this new one as well in Wessex called King Alfred's Way. And I think, you know, it's slightly different from bike touring in some ways, in that it's a bit more of a technical challenge. It's not just about stamina and enjoyment, really. You've got to have some degree of nifty bike handling skills for some of the gravel tracks. But it's enormously enjoyable form of cycling. I confess I have succumbed. I have bought myself a second-hand gravel bike, such as this is. So that sort of thing I would love to do.
Okay, well, let's head back over the border. I mean, I should say that probably the best part of Scotland to explore on a bike is not the Highlands. I mean, there are things like the West Highland Way, which is a great long-distance mountain biking route. And there are plenty of options for people who are willing to go properly off-road. But if you're interested in sort of traditional cycle touring on quiet lanes, then the Scottish borders are actually, you know, the place to go, really, aren't there? Because there's a lot more roads and a lot less traffic and many fewer tourists.
Absolutely. It is amazing how quiet Dumfries and Galloway is. You know, in terms of traffic, it feels like stepping back 20, 30 years, really. So many quiet lanes. And yes, all the way through the borders. It's great cycle touring country. You've got to be reasonably careful, as ever, in any fairly hilly area, that you don't get yourself corralled into a valley where the only road up is an A road. And sometimes, although it can be a lightly trafficked A road, maybe it's light traffic, but the traffic that there is going very fast. But yeah, generally you can't go too far wrong in that part of the world.
And let's have a look at the northern coast to coasts, which crisscross northern England. There was originally one, which was from the Cumbrian coast at Whitehaven over to Sunderland, I think. Does it go?
Yes.
On the east coast. And that was so popular that I think they devised a few more to kind of take up some of the traffic and spread it around a bit. Or maybe just other local tourist agencies thought, we want some of the sea-to-sea action. So now there are several routes across the skinniest bit of the British land mass. Which are your favourites?
Oh, there's a question. So, I mean, if we start with the sea-to-sea, the classic one, it is a really enjoyable ride, but I think people underestimate how hard it is. It is seriously hilly. There are some inclines there. Not so much Hartside. Hartside's the one everyone talks about, but actually that's just a bit of a slog. And if you put your head down and just go slowly, you'll get up there. There are some harder ones there. Going up Crawley Side Bank, that's an absolute beast. And there's a few others. So it's a great route, but do not underestimate it, and do not choose it as your first cycle tour, I would say. C2C is also partly responsible for me becoming a Sustrans ranger, because I tried to cycle it once about 15 years ago, and I got 20 miles into it and came off at high speed at the bottom of a hill, and managed to reshape my face in all sorts of interesting but not very aesthetic ways. So my excuse for that, I have no excuse, but my excuse for that is that I didn't see the sign at the bottom of the hill saying turn right until too late. And I thought, well, maybe if I'm enjoying this sort of route, I should give something back, and I should become one of the volunteers who go out there and make sure the signs are all in good order. So that's one of the things I've done. Do quite a lot of stuff for Sustrans in one capacity or another. But that was what got me started with that. So C2C is a good route, but a difficult one. Hadrian Cycleway is much easier, and it's got lots of tourist charm along it, because it goes along Hadrian's Wall, because it goes through a few nice little towns. I think that's a better one for your first coast to coast. The Way of the Roses as well, which is a more southerly one, goes from Lancaster across to York and then to the coast of Bridlington. That's a marvellous route. It's got some very, very scenic parts, even some of the early parts that I think people don't necessarily expect to be scenic. As soon as you're off the railway path out of Lancaster, it goes into the lovely countryside around the Forest of Bowland, that sort of area. Then you're going over to the Yorkshire Wolds, the other side of York. And, you know, no one ever thinks of going to the Yorkshire Wolds on holiday, but it's this beautiful rolling countryside. So again, less tough than the C2C, probably more to see, less of a challenge. And I would recommend that one to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think the Way of the Roses is really hard to beat. Always interesting, not too brutal, and varied in terms of countryside and interesting towns and cities. I think that's a great one. And it's also really well signposted. The signs have been done fairly recently, and they're very good. you could probably divert a little bit into the Yorkshire Dales if you wanted to, because that is just a cycling paradise in my view. It's compared to the Lake District, which the Lake District is very beautiful and it's a lovely place to cycle, but it does get full of people in cars, and there are fewer roads in the Lake District. It's a great place for going off-road on a bike, but the Yorkshire Dales has just got so many little lanes and quite a few good gravel tracks as well. And somehow it just seems to soak up all the visitors. And so you can really experience some solitude on a bike, as well as going through this beautiful limestone country. Oh, those sort of glacial valleys with the square fields and the little cowesses, the field barns that they have up there. It's just something utterly wonderful. If you've never been to the Yorkshire Dales, if you're a soft southerner like me, then you know it's going to be a journey of discovery and wonder.
It is beautiful.
How about the Reavers route? Because I think that's quite a good return. If you don't expire doing the C2C, or you're quite a fit cyclist, but you don't want to have to figure out how to get back. There is a train line back from Newcastle to Carlisle, so you can get back most of the way quite easily. But you could return on the Reavers. And that has both on-road and more off-road variants. So it's kind of got something for everyone.
It does. And I believe actually the creator of the route, Ted Liddell, who created the Reavers and several of the other coast-to-coast routes, is actually slightly revising it at the moment. He thinks there are a few improvements that could be made. I confess I haven't done it. I would like to. Again, as you're saying, some of the scenery around that part of the world is magnificent. Some of the wilds of Northumberland. And one route around there, which I have done and which I will rave about until the cows come home, is the Pennine Cycleway, which is a north-south route rather than a coast-to-coast. It's starts around Derby, Burton-upon-Trent, and goes up the spine of England to Berwick-on-Tweed. And that is a magnificent route. I think that pretty much matches Llanast Cymru for variety of scenery. Again, not an easy one, but some of the wilds up in Northumberland, even some of the southern Pennines, are places that people don't necessarily cycle that much and ought to. So yeah, that is a wonderful route.
We're yet to get to the slightly harder nut to crack in some ways than the kind of the north and the west of Britain, which is the Midlands and the southeast, because those are areas that have higher population density. They also have quite high density of country lanes, so it is possible to have great cycling in those in the Midlands and the southeast, but they're not quite as obvious, the choices for a set itinerary. What would be your picks for a route in the Midlands and a route in southeast southern England?
Oh, now there's a difficult one. I am a big fan of the Cotswolds, which is not that surprising because I chose to live here. And there is a lot of great cycling around here. Again, you have to be slightly careful about how you pick it, because there's a lot of cycling, but a lot of great cycling lanes. But there's also a lot of people driving Audis quite fast. So it's wonderful cycling country, but you've got to have a bit of nous about your route planning. One of the things I've done with my Sustrans volunteer hat on is that we have a route around here, which is Route 442 of the National Cycle Network, which is the Cotswold Line cycle route. And the reason it's called the Cotswold Line is because it follows the railway from Oxford to Worcester. So the notion with that is that you can ride as far as you like and then put your bike on the train and go home again. Quite an interesting challenge plotting and designing that route, because you've got to weigh up two things when you're designing a route like that. Partly, you want the route to be as quiet and as traffic-free as possible. You need to follow as many of the lost lanes, as a wise man once said. But conversely, because you're cycling through the Cotswolds, you want to see the Cotswolds. So you want to go through Morton in Marsh, you want to go through Chipping Campden, and unavoidably, going into those towns will take you on busier lanes than if you were just going on the quietest lanes all the time. So there is a balance to be struck there. We try to strike that balance in planning the route. I know a lot of people really enjoy it. I've seen plenty of loaded cycle tourists coming through here, and the cafes both here in Charlbury, where I live, and in the next village, Chadlington, do a roaring trade from supplying passing cyclists. So that would be my very biased recommendation, would be Oxford to Worcester on the Cotswold Line cycle route. But as I say, I planned that route, so I'm not necessarily an impartial witness.
Well, one route that I'd like to do in one go, I've done lots of bites of it in little segments, but I'd like to do it all in one go, is a sort of route that's become known as the Greater Ridgeway. So it goes from Hunstanton on the Norfolk coast down sort of diagonally across East Anglia and southern England to Dorset. And that takes in quite a variety of landscapes, from this kind of heathy, flat, arable East Anglia through the Chilterns, which is, you know, just outside London, but it's a really lovely swathe of hill country. Very quite gentle, but not always gentle on the knees, because there are some hills there. And then you cross the Thames at Goring, and then you kind of onto the classic Ridgeway, the Wessex Ridgeway, on the Berkshire Downs, and then into Wiltshire and the High Country, and great views across the sort of Oxfordshire flatlands to the north. And then you're into the kind of area of Stonehenge and Avebury and these fabulous sites from antiquity. And then you kind of, things get wilder and hillier into the sort of Dorset interior before you sort of emerge blinking onto a beach somewhere on the south coast. And it's a route that's got a lot of history to it, because it's recognised as being one of the oldest sort of trackways from Neolithic or Bronze Age Britain. And it's a walking route, quite well established, and you wouldn't be able to cycle on all the bits in the walking route. But I think with a bit of map work, you would be able to work out a good route of your own, following that kind of outline.
And I think that's where books like yours and websites like mine come in that they help people know what they're going to find on a route like that. So I think the route you've just described, there's going to be a fair amount of off-road on that. You know, the Ridgeway is essentially unsurfaced. So making sure that someone who is going to cycle that route knows what they're letting themselves in for, how tough it's going to be, what sort of bike or what sort of tyres they need to be able to do that. That can make the difference between someone's holiday being enjoyable and someone having a really lousy holiday because they kept puncturing every 10 miles or whatever it might be. And that's to a certain extent what I try to do with the route guides. And similarly, I think, you know, that's one of the great things that you get from your books, is that you can see, okay, this looks like a really enjoyable ride, but how am I going to do it? What am I going to need to do? Are there any modifications to the official route that maybe I should be making that will make it more suitable for me and the sort of cycling that I like to do?
Well, that's been a great overview of some of the set itineraries for long distance routes in Britain, and there are many more. Definitely worth having a browse of the cycle.travel website to see some of those, and Richard's route guides that he's written, which are really excellent. But we're going to talk now a little bit about planning your own route and using whatever choice of tools that works for you. But before we get to that, I want to hear from a friend of mine called Josie Parkinson, who went for a ride. And this is an interview I did long before COVID-19, asking her about her ride from Abergavenny to the Isle of Wight. And I thought it was interesting because she'd recently got into cycling. She's in her late 20s, younger and you know, with a different way of thinking about things than sort of the grey-haired, grizzled cycle tourists that Richard and I represent. So I thought it was kind of interesting to hear from somebody who was doing something for the first time, using kind of the tools of the time. Let's hear from me talking with Josie Parkinson about her trip from Abergavenny to the Isle of Wight via Stonehenge. So tell me about this bike ride you did.
So in August last year, I just decided to get on my bike and go from Abergavenny to the Isle of Wight. Didn't really know if I could do it or not. Just kind of wanted to give it a go, really, to the surprise and sort of disbelief of a lot of family and friends. Yeah, just decided to see if it's possible and if I can do something like that.
And how long had you been riding a bike?
It was a kind of a new hobby, to be honest. I think I was quite sort of late to the scene. I only really bought my first bike about 18 months before the trip. It was a road bike, just got it in a sale in a bike shop in Cheltenham, and just kind of discovered that I really like using it as a method of transport, just an alternative to getting in a car or using your legs. And then ever since buying that first one, tried to spend at least a bit of time every week just on a bike going somewhere and doing something fun somewhere outside.
So the Isle of Wight trip, yes. How did you go about planning the journey and making a journey?
So I sort of didn't do all that much planning, which I think turns out is quite a common trait of people that do bike tours. I had a week and a half off work and just wanted to do something a bit different with it. Some friends had talked about how lovely the Isle of Wight was, so I just thought, I'll see if I can get there on a bike. Planning-wise, I've got this brilliant app called Komoot, I don't talk about apps, but that has some great routes and how you kind of get around, and it builds up sort of a map of the UK of really popular, exciting cycle routes. So kind of piece together a journey on that app. Planning-wise as well, apart from that, I just had to do a bit of a shout out really to see who I could borrow stuff off, because I didn't really have any of the kits or any of the stuff that I really needed. But it was amazing actually how much stuff you can get just by asking your friends, because I don't think it actually has to be that expensive. I think a lot of people think these trips need to be a lot of cost involved and stuff, but really a lot of cyclists know other cyclists, and it turns out that cyclists are quite friendly, generous people. So a few shout outs on Facebook to friends and family, and I kind of had most of the equipment that I needed, to be honest. I had to buy, what did I buy? Just a rack that fitted my bike. And I think pretty much everything else I borrowed. So that was definitely part of the prep, was kind of getting that together. But I think people use this stuff like once or twice a year, and I think a lot of people are happy to kind of share it around and see it being used rather than just sat in a garage or just gathering dust in an attic.
So did you set yourself a distance that you needed to cover? I mean, you set out from Abergavenny one bright sunny morning. What happened?
I knew I had a week and a half and I wanted to get there, so between how I did that, I mean, how much a day I was doing, I didn't really have a particular time scale. I ended up doing most of my mileage on the first 2 days. I think once I started, I realised how much I did just want to get there, just to kind of prove to myself that I could do it. Mileage varied hugely from when I had more energy to when I've had less. So the first day I did sort of, I think, 80-ish, which is kind of as much of daylight as I could kind of get away with. And then slept very well my first night, and then kind of did another 60 miles, I think, the second day, just to kind of get there. And then once I was on the south coast, kind of thought, oh, right, I've done quite a few miles now. I can probably start to relax a bit. Got the ferry over and then had a bit of a holiday, but still getting on my bike every day and just travelling around, kind of getting from A to B. But yeah, not a huge amount of planning, to be honest. It was kind of just...
Did you have an idea of where you were going to end up every night and where you were going to stay?
I personally quite like to know where I'm going to sleep at night. Kind of by lunchtime, I like to know where I'm going to be. And so that was my ultimate goal. I'd get to lunchtime, see how much energy I had left, and then find a campsite that I thought was achievable within the rest of the daylight hours that I had. Find that and then try and get to that one. But that was only ever planned every morning, really. Some days you kind of wake up and not have a clue where you're going to go, what you're going to do. Whereas a few people that I met on the journey definitely said that they never knew where they were going to sleep. They'd just cycle until they kind of got really tired and then either find a campsite or find a warm showers person or find a suitable field just to pitch up their tent and just kind of get some sleep. So yeah, for me, I'd like to have a proper campsite, but that's a total different way of doing it. You can do it however works for you, I guess.
Did you use the Warm Showers community, or were you involved in the
warm? Yeah, so Warm Showers.
What is Warm Showers? Because I've heard about it, but I have never actually experienced it in the flesh.
Yeah, so I'm a massive advocate of Warm Showers. It's effectively just a bike touring version of couch surfing. So built on a sort of a philosophy of trust, I imagine, and kind of a bit of karma as well. So effectively, people just hosting bike tourists. So for free, just offering them a bed, often it's just a sofa bed or whatever is available. It can be a place in the garden to pitch a tent. But just people saying, you've been cycling all day, all you need is a bed and a shower, just come stay with us. And you make a profile online. People are kind of suspicious, I think, at the moment in society. And I think it's not really a leap of faith. It's just kind of putting yourself out there and just saying, yeah, I want to meet some nice people. And we've got this big thing in common. And therefore, let's just make the most of this opportunity. And yeah, so I did that. I think three of the nights I was away. And people are quite surprised, actually, because sort of as a young solo cyclist, female cyclist, I guess people are kind of a bit wary of who you could be staying with. I had absolutely no bad experiences. I've never heard anybody having a bad experience with it. If anything, I had the opposite. I met some brilliant people. I was hosted. I was fed. I was given beer. I was given advice. It's just people are so generous. And I was just really overcome with how kind strangers can be to other strangers. And I think that's something that we really need to push more of in our society. And yeah, I'm happy to spread the word about that as much as I can.
So how does it work on a practical level? Because when I've thought about it, I thought, well, if I'm going to be rocking up at someone's house, I'm going to need to give them loads of warning, like weeks in advance, so that it's not inconvenient for them. But then you're talking about not knowing where you're going to be every night.
I was very last minute. I decide that sort of in the morning and think, oh, I'm going to try and get to Bournemouth this evening. I wonder if there's anybody in Bournemouth that might be available today to put me up. And I think people like that, to be honest. I think they don't really want too much planning advance because it's a yes or no. Are you in the mood to host? Are you not? You have an app. So again, it was very quick to message and you get sort of a notification when someone's responded. I preferred to always speak to someone on the phone in the morning just to kind of have a quick chat. And I think you can kind of sense somebody's personality through having a quick chat in the morning. So yeah, that was quite a good gauge of how it would be. And often they said no. They said, I'm really sorry, I'm busy, but try this person down the road. And I was never without a bed, basically, deciding I was going to do that on the morning. So it worked out really well.
How did the whole experience match up to your expectations of what it would be like?
Yeah, I definitely hugely enjoyed it and got a lot out of it, I think. Doing it by yourself is something that's really important to me generally. I think everybody needs to do some sort of solo trip like that at some point in their life. Just the main thing being just the sense of empowerment it gives you, particularly on a bicycle, that you can get a huge amount of distance covered just by yourself, your legs and a bike. So that sense of achievement meant that it was just hugely enjoyable, and I definitely want to do another one. There were lows, there were highs and lows, but almost you need to have the lows for the sense of achievement, because I think if you just coasted through it and there weren't any challenges, it isn't really that, you wouldn't have that sense of achievement and you wouldn't feel that you grow as a result of it, which is definitely something that I think I felt personally after sort of a first bike tour.
Tell us about some of the lows.
Oh my goodness. What were the lows? Meeting a few interesting people that you couldn't really shake off. It wasn't really a low as such, but I think if you start to tag along with another person, you can end up kind of, it's quite difficult to kind of break those ties. And once you got into the solo mindset, I became a bit grumpy, I think, and I kind of wanted to do things by myself as much as possible. And sometimes people just really want to talk to you because they think if you're by yourself, you must be a bit lonely, and that's just people being lovely and, you know, wanting to kind of make sure you're okay. But often you're fine, you're just doing something by yourself, and so you end up talking and talking and talking to people and kind of wanting to just have a bit more time to yourself. Just when you go to a pub and you're by yourself and people automatically start talking to you, and so it wasn't such a low as much. That was just a sort of an interesting observation of something that kind of kept on happening. What other lows were there?
Did you ever hit the wall physically? I mean, it's something that I do on almost all of my tours. I'll get to some point where I just feel like I've really overcooked it, and I'm going to fall over in a hedge.
That's bonking, I think they call it, don't they? When you just hit a wall. That definitely happened. The sort of third day, I started to get a real niggle in my knee and starting to feel a little bit defeated by it. And I think when you start to get something physically wrong with you, that's a different sort of, you can get psychologically tired, but it's just frustrating to get sort of a physical injury, because the fear of that is, what happens if this is really bad? I'm going to have to get a train all the way home, and that's not the end of the world, but I've still got a week left. I don't want to just train it back. So once you start to get a bit of pain, that's not great. But I mean, it's interesting. People always say that you do get stronger, and it's so true. I was really surprised by that. You physically get stronger as you go on, and I think your body kind of gets more used to it. So I had like a rest day for my fourth day, and then just felt fine on the next day, and managed to do another load of miles then. And so again, just sort of discovering things about yourself and your body as well, which is was really interesting.
Are there any moments that were particularly fantastic that stick in your mind vividly?
I think the first day, feeling, just getting really tired towards the end of the first day, just sort of heading towards the campsite, getting to Stonehenge, and realizing how hungry I was, and that I hadn't seen a cafe for quite a while, or a pub or anything. And then I suddenly just came across a field of raspberries and blueberries. It was that season of just huge raspberry canes, and just feeling like I could actually like just on the side and kind of helping myself to them, and realizing this is absolutely amazing. Probably wasn't free food at the time, but it felt like, I don't really believe in God, but if there was a God and he gave me all this field of fruit, and that was great. Yeah, that was a highlight. I think meeting some of the people that I did through the warm showers, that was really interesting. Actually, they gave me some like local recommendations of places to go and things to do, and I was just really overcome with how kind they were, and how much knowledge they wanted to share. So that was definitely a highlight. I think swimming in the sea on the Isle of Wight was just incredible. It's such a beautiful place. I hadn't appreciated it. It felt like properly going on holiday without really going that far away. Sea swimming over there was brilliant. Yeah. And just being able to kind of just be on your bike and just decide, I'm just going to have a bit of a break now. I'm going to just hop off and do that. And I think that's one really good thing about doing it by yourself, is you don't have to consult anybody if you want to just take a detour or just take a few hours off or something like that.
And in terms of the route, were there any bits that you thought, oh gosh, I'm so glad I'm cycling here, or oh man, what am I doing on this dual carriageway?
Yes, both. Definitely both of those. So starting with the first one, I think the New Forest was spectacular. I've never discovered that before, but just along the south, just the roads, it's quite flat, which was very appreciative after sort of coming down past Bournemouth Way. But yeah, just stunning sort of at dusk, just the sun going down and just being on those winding sort of beautiful roads, sort of undulating hills down there, was spectacular. And in terms of, the other thing, you just have to keep your eye on roads. And if you get a sense that it's wrong, even if your navigation is telling you go that way, just don't go that way. Because I did find myself in a few A roads being beeped at and shouted at. And that's never ideal. I think sometimes a funny thing about that sort of cyclist versus car mentality is often cyclists don't want to be there either, and the cars presume that the cyclist is there because that's their intention, and often they didn't mean to get onto that A road. Because I did find myself a couple of times on roads that I was desperately trying to get off without knowing how to do that for a little bit of time. So that wasn't great, but it all added to the trip. It all added to just the tapestry of experiences.
And if you were to say to someone else who's thinking about maybe doing their first cycle tour, what would you say?
I'd say pack half the amount of clothes you think you're going to need, because, I ended up living in about two outfits for the week, so definitely overpacked. I'd say don't plan, really. Obviously plan your first day or two, but just let yourself be led by how you feel every day without having a particularly determined route to follow, and be very open to changing your plans if you feel in a different mood one day. So yeah, not overplan, I guess. I'd say don't worry about it too much, I guess, which fits into that last point. But I was so worried before I started, and then within the first half day, just realised that once you get a certain way, you can do it. And if you get tired, you just stop. So what's the worst that's going to happen? And particularly if you're just starting in the UK, like, it's not like you're ever going to be that far away from Halfords. So Halfords are open on Sundays as well. So that saved me a few times. Yeah.
So did you have some mechanical troubles at all, or were you lucky in that sense?
I was definitely lucky. I think that was one of my biggest worries, was sort of technical fixing knowledge is pretty limited. Didn't get a puncture at all, which was incredible. Did absolutely destroy my brake pads on the first day, and only noticed from a brief inspection the morning of the second day, which was a Sunday morning, and I didn't bring any spares with me because I didn't think about that. But hooray for Halfords, because they fixed it and put them in for me as well, which, yeah, so overall I was quite lucky. But there are so many bike shops in the UK, lovely independent guys that will just stop and sort you out then and there if they need to. So, yeah, mechanical wise, I was pretty safe, really, I think.
And so is it a box that you've ticked and you're going to move on to something else, or has this whetted your appetite for more? And have you got any other plans?
I want to do as much of it as I can over the next year. So imminently moving to New Zealand, so definitely going to do as much of it as I can over there. I mean, it's interesting, people have very varied views about travelling across New Zealand bike touring, because you do have to stretch a big distance before you get to another town, and people, sometimes that can be a bit intimidating to have to go quite far before you get to something, whereas other people think that's great, and actually those in-between stages are what make the journey, really. It sounds so cheesy, but it's not the destination, it is the journey between the locations, so it's just ultimately what you want to get out of the trip. So I'll definitely be doing some over there. I only use a road bike though, so it's not really geared up for proper touring. So it might be, if I get more into it, that I switch it for something that's kind of a bit more robust for that. But it suits me fine. It's just another one of those things. You think you need to have the right kit and you need to have the right bike, but actually you can just make do with what you've got, really. Just stick a rack on the back of it and get some panniers and a helmet, and hey, way to go, really. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see.
So that was Josie Parkinson talking about her bicycle tour, her first bicycle tour from Abergavenny to the Isle of Wight via Stonehenge. What struck you about that, Richard? Because it is interesting to hear from people about doing something for the first time, sort of fresh eyes on something that you know very well.
So you and I suspect, will probably pore over maps for days and days before going somewhere. We know one end of an Ordnance Survey map from another. We know how to use the various online tools. We have libraries full of books with great rides in them. And so, you know, we are able to plan in quite a lot of detail. Lots of first-time cycle tourists do not do that. They will go straight to a website of their choice. They will punch in their start and their end point, and they will just go and ride that. And so that puts a bit of an onus on those of us who run such websites to make sure it gets them right. So pleased to see that Josie had a really good route planned for her by Komoot, I think it was. I've seen people do that by punching things into Cycle Travel, into Google Maps, into whatever it might be. So, yeah, need to remember that although we might overthink these things, oftentimes people just say, I want to go for a bike ride, I'm going to go where the computer tells me.
It really is the generational change, isn't it, from, you know, you and me and lots of other people of our generation and older, I suppose, who really think in terms of a map. Maybe we've moved from a paper map to a digital map, but we're still thinking about plotting the route ourselves, working it out, rather than the kind of Google Maps generation, which is doesn't think in terms of maps, wouldn't know what an A to Z of London was. It's all about punching the thing in and then getting sat-nav type turn-by-turn directions, you know, how to go.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that people do it that way, and actually delighted that it works out for them, because I would never let a machine choose my route for me on a bicycle. I've just had too many experiences where,
you know, it send you down some kind of overgrown shrubbery or across or along a sort of four-lane highway with no verge. I just think the kind of things that it could do that would just drive me mad. I just don't want to let it happen. I want to be in control. I'll certainly let it do a first draft, but then I'll revise it myself. But Josie seemed absolutely happy just going for it. And like, I don't know, I kind of salute her happy-go-lucky ways, really, because maybe I'm just a bit boring.
One of the nicest bits of feedback I've ever had for Cycle Travel was someone who, I think it was on the Cycle Chat discussion forum, just punched in Swindon to the Orkneys and just rode it. People were offering him some route advice. He said, no, I'm just going to follow which way Cycle Travel sends me. And it found him a good route, which is good because I would not have slept for the next week if he had had a lousy time as part of it. So I'm relieved that worked.
So let's just cover briefly OS, Ordnance Survey Maps, which, you know, I use extensively in planning my rides and the routes in my books. Land Ranger 1 to 50,000, whether you've got it on paper or whether you've got it on the app or whether you're using it through some website, is I think, the cycle touring kind of map of choice. And I tend to go for the yellow roads, which come in two types, a sort of wider one and a narrow one, and the narrow one are the really lost lanes, I would call them, because they're too narrow to allow two cars to pass each other. That is almost the definition, and so cars avoid them or travel very slowly if they do have to use them. So they are the ones that I go for, and I find Ordnance Survey maps are very rich, lots of interesting information about kind of ruins and things along the way. They're well labelled. They feel like it's cartography by hand by artists. Whereas you go to digital mapping, you go to OpenStreetMap, Google Maps, cycle.travel, and it is cartography that's generated by a machine. Is that fair?
That's fair, but it's worth saying that you can be more artisan if you want to be. So Cycle Travel has a few things that it does for the machine-generated cartography to make it particularly clear to cyclists. So, you know, one really simple example is that it brings in pubs and cafes at an earlier zoom level in the countryside than it does in towns and cities, because if you're planning a 50-60 mile tour, you want to be able to see a good span of your route on screen at once, but at the same time you want to know where the pubs and cafes that you're going to stop at on the way are, whereas you don't want, for example, the centre of Bristol or Oxford or wherever it might be to be completely illegible because of the number of pub icons that are showing there at this particular zoom level. So cartography, yes. I mean, I think OS 1 to 50k Land Rangers are the absolute pinnacle of the cartographic art. I absolutely love them. But nonetheless, there is a lot that people can do with computerized cartography to make it more appealing and more readable. And to a certain extent, I think people aren't doing that as much as they could. I would love to see people such as, you know, Google or Bing, the really mass market cartography people, taking perhaps a bit more pride in the artisan side of things. But then, you know, from Google's point of view, the map is not really a map. It's a canvas on which you show search results and to a certain extent advertising results. So they want the map to be very plain. That's why their cartographic style is white roads on a grey background, which makes me cringe every single time. But it means that the search results they want to highlight stand out nice and clearly.
And your maps have brought back the art of hill shading, which is something that used to be, you know, part and parcel of a cycle touring map from the days of Bartholomew's maps, where, you know, the hill country that is darker than the lowlands. And so it's quite easy to sort of see, OK, I really need to avoid that big lump there. And that's not always clear when you're looking at a map that renders hills using contours.
Oh, I have lost so many days of my life to that hill shading because I'm never content with it. There is always a little bit of adjustment you can do to the ramp or to the colour choice just to make it a bit clearer. And then you'll come up with something and you've been testing it in Snowdonia and you think, that's it, I finally cracked it. And then you pan over to the Alps and you think, oh my goodness me, it does not work here at all. So yeah, I love hill shading, but anyone who has tried to do it, I'm sure Andy Allen, who does Open Cycle Map, and a lot of other people will tell you the same story. It's just fiendishly difficult to get right, but it looks lovely when you do.
So aside from how the thing looks and the information that it contains, let's talk about routing And if you let Cycle Travel or another website route you and determine your route from point A to point B, how does it do that? What information does it use? And does it come up with a different result depending on whether you're using cycle.travel or Komoot or Google Maps?
It does, absolutely. And the way that all of these route planners work is that they score every single bit of road and path throughout Europe, the world, for its suitability for cycling. So they will say, I'm going to give this a score of 10 because it's a lovely quiet road with a smooth surface and no sharp hills. Or I'm going to give this a score of 5 because it's quiet, but it's got a 14% gradient, all of that sort of thing. And then effectively, when you say, I want to have a route from Oxford to Birmingham, it will put all of that together and find the route which overall gets the best score. So there's two variables in that which explain why different route planners find different routes. One of them is the data source they use. And effectively, there's only 4 worldwide data sources for a navigable street map. They are Google, OpenStreetMap, Here and TomTom. Here and TomTom don't really have much of a presence in cycling, so it's pretty much either Google or OpenStreetMap. The second thing is how you actually score all these roads, and that is why, although Komoot and Cycle Travel and Ride with GPS and a lot of these sites all use OpenStreetMap data, the scoring that they use is different. So Cycle Travel will come up with a different weighting for the various roads between Oxford and Birmingham than Komoot will, and that will cause Cycle Travel to route you a different way because it says, OK, I've added up these particular roads and that gets a better score.
And so what led you to this, to the weighting of criteria that you've got on your site, and what will be the material difference between a route plotted on yours versus one plotted on Komoot, say?
So there's 2 main differences that I'd pick out. One is that Cycle Travel looks in a huge amount of depth at the source material, the OpenStreetMap source material. I've been involved in OpenStreetMap since about 5 months after it was founded in 2004, so from the very earliest days, and seen it grown from something which was just a few roads and paths around about Regent's Park, which is where the first roads were plotted, up to the state where now it is the single biggest probably the single biggest map data set there is in the world. So as part of knowing about that, I've managed to sort of bring a lot of knowledge to bear in the decisions that Cycle Travel makes. The other thing which Cycle Travel does, which is unusual, is that it looks where the data is available at real motor traffic levels. So I feel quite strongly that a good cycle route is not defined by the number of cyclists on it. It's defined by the absence of cars. I don't really mind if I'm riding along a road and there are 20 other cyclists or no other cyclists. What I mind is whether I'm being buzzed every 5 seconds by a car going past me. So where that data is available, and it isn't always, Cycle Travel will use that to keep you off the busy roads and onto the quiet roads. And so quite a lot of the work I've been doing has been scouting around various open data sets across the world to say, OK, you know, can we get this data for France? Can we get this data for Spain? And so on and so forth, so that Cycle Travel can make better route choices there. France is a particularly interesting one because everything is a D road. The government has decided that it doesn't want to, basically it doesn't really want to run roads centrally. It's pushed them all down to the département, the counties, as it were. So that means that 2 roads that nominally have the same class can be very, very different cycling experiences.
That's interesting. So you're taking traffic information into account, not just the classification of the road.
Yes, and it makes a big difference in Britain as well, especially if you go into Scotland. I think when I first started Cycle Travel, I wasn't doing this. I was just working on the class of the road. And although that would work fine, say, around here in the Cotswolds, where, as a general rule, you just want to keep off the A roads, as soon as you got into Scotland, it was telling you to go over these insane hills and these really quite difficult technical gravel tracks over the mountains because it wanted to keep you off the A roads. And I thought, well, hang on, the A roads there are fine. They have got not much traffic on them in particular places in the Highlands. They're often single track a lot of the time. So how can Cycle Travel be smart enough to know that it can take an A road in this part of the Highlands, but not in this part of the Cotswolds? And the answer is to look at the traffic levels.
And how about for where you do go off-road? How do you determine whether that is a really nice hard-packed gravel surface or a tarmac cycleway or a good towpath or some kind of horse-infested quagmire with overgrown with brambles and nettles? Because that doesn't appear on the map, does it?
So cycle travel has a small distinction between different types of right-of-way that shows up on the map. Sometimes you will see that they are dotted brown lines, which means they're rough, and sometimes you will see they're dashed brown lines, which means they are probably a bit more rideable. Where the information is in the OpenStreetMap data source, that's great. You know, sometimes people have said this has got a gravel surface or this has got a mud surface, or sometimes they've just given it a score out of five. They've said, you know, this is score grade five. This is basically not very good for cycling on at all. That's great where that information exists. A lot of the time it doesn't. A lot of the time it's just this is a bridle way and no further information about that. Because OpenStreetMap is all about the information that the contributors have put in there, and that depends how interested someone was to record the surface quality. So cycle travel makes quite a lot of sort of assumptions and judgments based on other factors to say, okay, is this bridleway likely to be something that's rideable or not? And I always try to err on the side of caution because, once again, I don't want to ruin anyone's day. I don't want to send someone down a bridleway which they will get completely muddy and swamped in. It doesn't always work. I mean, I have been on National Cycle Network routes that have nominally been cyclable and that have actually been absolute quagmires. But generally speaking, the better information that there is in OpenStreetMap, the more informed decision that cycle travel can make.
I mean, I find one way of getting a bit more information on the quality of a track is to use a website, which is a kind of sister website in a way of OpenStreetMap, called Geograph, geograph.org.uk, I think. And that is started off as a crowdsourcing project to get a photograph, a representative photograph of every grid square in Great Britain logged, so people could kind of see what the country looked like at that level of granularity and locality. But it's actually accumulated a lot more than just one image per grid square, and so it's quite useful to look at a track on Geograph, and then it will pull up all the photographs that people have taken around there, and then looking at those photographs you can usually sort of deduce what kind of track it is. Also, you can use Google Maps satellite view to gauge a little bit whether something's going through a wood or is in kind of open country and whether the surface is hard packed or not. None of these are fail-safe methods, but they're quite useful for confirming a hunch or you're ruling out a route.
Yeah, I agree. Geograph is a wonderful resource, and it's integrated to some extent into cycle travel, so that if you're planning a route, you can click on the segment of it and you'll see a little balloon appears which has the link in it saying view photos. If you click view photos, those photos come from Geograph. So you, if it's put you along a bit of bridle way or a bit of track where you're not sure what the surface quality is, then you can click there and see some photos which will hopefully give you an indication of whether it's rideable or not.
Brilliant. Well, let's turn to a few questions from people on Twitter. I announced a couple of hours ago on Twitter that we were going to be talking, and people got very excited about that, or a handful of people did. So let's go to a couple of questions. So this is Dave Walker, who runs a new... He's a cartoonist and does some great cartoons about cycling.
He does great ones about church choirs as well. I have used his cartoons with my choir, so yes, big fan.
The Venn diagram of church choirs and cycling contains both you and Dave and a few other people, I should think, besides. The question is, would a cycling map that includes rideable bridleways be a possibility? Also, Joe Dunkley asks about how do you tell, looking at a National Cycle Network route, you know, what the quality of the route's going to be. Is there any way of telling what it's going to be like?
It's very difficult because there is no machine-readable source of how good a bridleway is. There is nothing, no big database that I can pull in that says that this particular bridleway is great for cycling and this one isn't. So all I could encourage people to do there is contribute to OpenStreetMap. Go to OpenStreetMap if there is a bridleway that you know about. Put something in there about the surface quality. Give it the grade from 1 to 5 that OpenStreetMap uses. Say whether it's a gravel surface or a mud surface or whatever it might be. And then when that information goes into OSM, that means that Cycle Travel and Komoot and Ride with GPS and all these different sites will be able to pull that information out and make more informed routing decisions based on that. And maybe, you know, sometime someone might build a gravel bike router or a ride-away router that makes decisions not so much based on the criteria that Cycle Travel uses at present, but the sort of criteria say, oh yeah, you know, I like a bit of mud, or I like a bit of a single track ploughing off-road.
Didn't Sustrans a couple of years ago do a full audit of the National Cycle Network? So haven't they got that information on what their network is like at the ground level for every inch of it?
They have for the NCN, yes.
And have they put that into OpenStreetMap's database?
The intention is to release it as open data, but that hasn't happened yet. So Sustrans is going through a project at the moment which is called Paths for Everyone, but which is essentially the National Cycle Network review. And the idea of that is to look in a lot of detail at all 15,000 miles of the NCN and to say, okay, of those bits which are not up to par, and, you know, Sustrans fully recognises the bit that, as the rest of us know, that there are lots of bits of the NCN that are not up to par. Of those bits that aren't, are they fixable? If so, how do they get fixed? And if they're not fixable, then let's remove them from the National Cycle Network. So that is in its reasonably early stages at the moment. But, you know, I don't think I'm breaking too many confidences to say that the NCN probably in a year's time is going to be smaller than it is at the moment, because there are just some sections that are not good and not realistically capable of being brought up to a decent standard.
So another question. This is Anthony Galvin, and he asked a really good question about B roads, because B roads used to be the backbone of cycle touring, so long distance multi-day cycle touring infrastructure. So back in the 1970s, if you pick up a route guidebook from published in the 1970s, it would feature B roads very heavily. But since then, B roads have become actually some of the most terrifying roads, because they have been painted with a line down the middle and lines at the side. They're too narrow and too winding to allow for safe overtaking of a cyclist, yet they are roads that are used increasingly by car commuters who are, you know, in a rush to get home to their countryside cottage from their big city job, and white van man and all the rest of it, delivery vehicles. So how do you decide whether a B road is a death trap or is actually a pleasant cycling road? Because there are some B roads in the country which are fine, and not heavily trafficked. I'm thinking particularly maybe some of the B roads in the Welsh borders and the sort of Shropshire and Powys are fine, but then other B roads, Southeast England in particular, are horrible.
Absolutely. And this goes back to using the real motor traffic data again. So the B road data, which is available, is not quite as good quality as the A road data, but it is there. So what I've tried to do is use that data to rate the rate B roads, to say that this one has got, 20,000 cars a day on it, so is absolutely no chance I'm going to suggest anyone rides that. Whereas this one here has got 500 cars a day, so that's a much more appealing proposition. As you say, this has changed over the years, and this is one of the main reasons why it's sometimes good to use a route planning website rather than simply just a paper map, because a paper map doesn't actually give you that information. It just gives you the orange line and it says B6047, and you don't know from that how busy it's going to be. You can maybe make a bit of a guess, given that it's got a town at this end and a town at that end and people are going to be driving between the two, but you don't always know that. And sometimes you get surprised, to be honest. The traffic data for the roads across the Pennines showed me that there is an A road which has got virtually no traffic on it. And you think, well, this seems slightly strange. But I think, is it the A640? It's one of the roads between Manchester and Huddersfield. Yeah, 640. And the traffic for an A road is absolutely minimal. It's the sort of thing that would be an unclassified road in large parts of the country. And so having that data hopefully means that the website can make a more informed routing choice.
In terms of choosing to use an online cycle route planner like cycle.travel or like Wahoo or Ride with GPS, one quite good way to road test it before you actually hand over your holiday to the machine is to plot a journey that you do regularly in your area, that you know how you'd like to do it, and then ride the route or just look at the route that it has suggested and see how that corresponds to to your own view of the best route. I mean, it may be that it turns out something that is actually better than what you know, but yeah. Also it may reveal the weaknesses or the biases or the different considerations that each routing engine will emphasize. So if you're kind of comparing it against something that you know already, that should give you a little bit of faith in terms of going into the unknown.
Absolutely. And to a large extent, that's how I test cycle travel. I will plan a route on it. And if it's not taking me the way that I would personally take, then I will look into the data and say, OK, why is it making that particular decision? Is the decision that it's making a good one? And if not, what can I do in terms of adjusting the algorithm to make a better route? And so cycle travel is a lot better now than it was when I started just a few years ago at finding decent routes, because I keep refining the route finding algorithm on my experiences and on other people's experiences. I get lots and lots of good feedback from people who've planned routes, and sometimes they'll say, well, why is it sent me this way rather than that way? I'll have a look. Oh yeah, well, okay, maybe if I adjust this bit, then it will make a better choice.
And so once you've planned your route, what's the best way to actually follow it on your bike?
Well, I'm quite old-fashioned in that I quite like printing out a paper map and just shoving it in my pocket. You can put things on your mobile phone. You can put things on your Garmin. There is a really bewildering number of file formats that Garmins will happily accept. And so Cycle Travel offers you the opportunity to export into one of those. I'm working slowly on an app, which will mean that you can just call it straight up on your phone from Cycle Travel. But that is, that's quite a big undertaking. So I can't promise it's going to be finished next Saturday. Personally, I use a combination of paper printouts, the Garmin on the handlebars, and a mobile phone, which I just use a little app called MapOut, which is a very clear outdoor-focused mapping app for the iPhone. I load the GPX track onto that, and if I'm not sure where to go, get the phone out and see where.
Some people end up using a particular route guiding tool simply because the integration with their chosen device, whether a Garmin or a Wahoo, is very tight. It's just a sort of one click synchronization. You've determined the route on your phone while you're out in the countryside, then you press send to Wahoo and it's immediately there. And I've
Indeed.
Done that and that's quite and I use Ride with GPS to do that, because it's just very seamless the way it works. I've used cycle.travel in that way, but it's a couple more steps. You have to download a GPX file to your phone, and then I have to send it to Dropbox, and then I have to port it from Dropbox into my Wahoo, and it just sort of, there's a few more steps that you have to manage. Is there a little bit of technological determinism here?
It is.
What's easiest wins?
I'm very pleased to say that within about a week's time, then I will have the one-stop click to send for Garmin. I'm working on the Garmin integration at the moment, so you'll be able to send it straight through to Garmin Connect, and that sends it by Bluetooth to your little Garmin device. So that will be getting a lot easier in about a week's time or so. Wahoo, not here yet. It's a matter of whether Wahoo allow integration for little artisan providers like me rather than the massively funded beasts that are Komoot and the like, but we shall see.
It's interesting how these things get determined. So let's, you've got your route, you've planned it at home, or you just take a chance like Josie did. You've got it onto your phone or whatnot. You're ready to go. What do you pack in your panniers? And then where do you sleep for the night? I mean, these are big questions, but there are a lot of options out there. And I don't know how you feel. Maybe we should just talk about how things are going to be this summer with the COVID situation, insofar as we can tell, because it's difficult to know what's happening with accommodation, campsites being open. All of that has a bearing on what kind of route you can take. What are your thoughts on how it's going to be this summer?
Yes, I think camping in particular, in theory, camping should be incredibly COVID friendly. You're outside, you're not in a situation where you're likely to be transmitting it. But there seems to be quite a lot of reluctance, basically, around the issue of shared toilets, that campsites do not necessarily want to open to campers. They're quite happy with motor caravans because motor caravans have their own integral toilet that you just pour down a drain. But generally, we don't cart around one of those around on panniers. Well, I certainly don't. So that's there seems to be a bit of reluctance about that. And so I think, you know, you're seeing people talking about wild camping, which is terrific fun, but obviously of dubious legality in lots of Britain. I think the other thing, which isn't necessarily something that people would think about, is to consider the chain hotels, to be honest, to consider the people like Premier Inn and Travelodge and such. Like, okay, it's not necessarily the most soulful experience, but they have two great advantages. One is that they're usually pretty bike friendly. They will let you take your bike into your room. And also they have the cleaning routines down pat. They are all very keen to reopen. They don't mind how you've arrived there. They are going to completely disinfect your room on the way in and the way out. So they are plenty happy for you to stay overnight. It's not quite as authentic a cycling camping experience, maybe, but if it means you can get out there and have a great time, I'm all for it.
What I sometimes used to do when I was doing longer journeys on my own before the children came along was this kind of prince and pauper rotation of accommodation. Mm. So I'd sort of spend a couple of nights wild camping, then a couple of nights in a formal campsite where you had hot running water and that kind of thing, and then one night a week in a hotel or a B&B where you could, you know, have a really good clean and do a bit of laundry and have a really good night's sleep and sort of do it on that rotation, which kind of makes your money last a little bit longer and kind of gives you something to look forward to.
I did a bit of that on the River Loire last year in France because I planned my cycle trip there and hoped that July in France would be good weather. July in France was very good weather, as in 40 degrees centigrade good weather. And with the best will in the world, I am not roughy-tufty enough to camp outside in 40 degree heat. I wanted a hotel, ideally with a fan or some air conditioning on a night like that. So on the days when the temperature was manageable, I camped. And on the days when it was getting 40, 41, 42 degrees, I found myself a hotel. I'm not proud.
Well, one thing you can do in France, which I wish you could do in Britain, is walk into the Office du Tourisme, which exists in every small town in France, and ask them at about, 5 o'clock in the evening, when you've just done your day's cycling, is there anywhere to stay nearby? And they will look up their availability information that is collated from their local providers, B&Bs and campsites and that kind of thing, and tell you, you know, exactly, you say what you want, what you're looking for, what your price range is roughly, and they'll say, oh yeah, well, go and see Madame Dubois, you know, a couple of miles up the road, she's got space for you and she makes really delicious yogurt for breakfast, or there's this campsite up here but it's quite a big one and this one is a bit more rustic, and you've got an actual person advising you not just on what there is but what there is available. Mm. And that seems to me to be the big problem, and that's a problem that I anticipate this summer in Britain, with so many people staycationing, with campsites potentially running and other accommodation providers running at lower occupation than they would normally to provide for sort of social distancing and cleanliness and all that, that it's going to be bookings only. And I think it takes quite a brave person to book 10 nights ahead for a cycle tour, because, you know, it just takes one thing to go wrong or one little extra day or you need a rest day or something like that, and you are out of sync with your plan and all your bookings and it all just falls apart.
One thing that cycle touring has the great advantage of is that very often you'll be going in the less touristy areas. So yes, I think you're absolutely right that the Lake District is going to be completely booked up this summer. The Pembrokeshire coast is going to be completely booked up, lots of places like that. But there are cycle touring routes that take you through much less popular parts of the country. You know, I can pretty much guarantee that the Pennine Cycleway is not going to be booked up this summer just because it goes through remote places. There are, you know, routes through the Midlands. There's a nice National Cycle Network route that goes through Leicestershire and Rutland. These are not tourist hotspots, and I pretty sure that even in this summer of the staycation, you will be able to phone up a rural B&B in Leicestershire at 12 o'clock on the day and say, I want to stay overnight. Have you got a space? And you'll be able to find somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's good advice. An app that I have used, and I don't know what you think about it, it does feel like it might be a kind of corporate giant that screws its service providers. I mean, not the customer, but the people on the who are providing the accommodation, is a website called booking.com, which works actually quite well. I mean, one nice thing about cycling is that compared to walking, say, is you can widen your search area for a bed for the night that further than you could if you were just walking. So you can say, OK, well, I'm looking for a place to stay within 10 miles or 5 miles of my ideal destination point for that day's riding. And it will search what's available, at least what's available on its databases, and come back to you with live, you know, information. And you can even just click it and say book and you're booked in. But I have to say, I don't know whether they are the good guys or not. They're certainly very convenient as a service.
So I like all these recommendations you're making for Geograph, which is integrated into Cycle Travel, and booking.com, because Cycle Travel talks to booking.com as well, in that if you're planning a route, you can click somewhere on the route, say find accommodation, and that will then head off to booking.com and find the hotels or B&Bs that are in the area where you've clicked. So you can use that to find accommodation along your tour. It doesn't have the live availability on Cycle Travel itself. So you have to find the hotel, then go through to booking.com, and that will tell you once you're there whether it's available or not. But I've used that quite a lot of times to find accommodation, because otherwise, you know, especially if you're somewhere you're not particularly familiar with, you find yourself just Googling, you know, hotel in Oswald Twistle, and there's nothing in Oswald Twistle. So you think, oh, okay, where am I searching for next? And you find another random place name. Whereas doing the geographic search, which is what Cycle Travel does, allows you to find all of the hotels within a particular radius of where you want to stay for the night.
Great. Well, that's accommodation sorted. Eating, very important. You've got to fuel the engine. You don't want to be hungry as you're cycling around. How are things going to be? I mean, traditionally, the main thing you have to worry about is getting to the pub for lunch before the kitchen closes at 2 p.m. sharp. And that often involves a kind of crazy sprint from sort of 1:40 for like 20 minutes, with everybody arriving absolutely exhausted at 2:05. And the chef has just gone off shift and you're offered some scampi fries and an extra pint. And that's not a very satisfying way to have lunch. I think things are going to be a little bit different this summer with pubs. I think a lot of pubs are going to be wanting bookings. They're going to have to manage their customers more carefully, and they want to know who's coming and how many are coming. I'm thinking that it'd be worth packing a little stove, a few basics to eat, so you can actually have your own sort of your own food if you need it.
Always have a backup, and I've learned that the hard way. There have been days when I've been out on the bike. I think, you know, for example, one day I was cycling the Mercian Way, NCN Route 45, that starts at Salisbury, and my first day I was trying to get to Swindon. I was at Avebury around lunchtime, and I thought, well, you know, this will be a nice place to have some lunch. But actually, all the pubs were a bit touristy and a bit expensive, and I thought, no, I don't really feel like this. I'll head on a bit further, which was a stupid mistake, because there was absolutely nothing between Avebury and Swindon apart from a corner shop on the outside of Swindon, which would sell me a can of Monster Energy drink and a pack of crisps. So since then, I've learned always have some sort of backup. It doesn't necessarily have to be particularly tasty. By definition, it's probably not going to be, because you want something that isn't going to go off. But you don't want to get into that situation where you stop enjoying the ride because you've got a steep hill in front of you and you haven't had your lunch.
And in terms of clothes and other things that you might carry on a bicycle tour, I think the traditional advice is lay everything out on your bed and then halve it. Is that something you'd endorse, or would you go further? What kind of things do you think are essential and that things people might not have thought about, and which things are definite candidates for leaving at home?
I know it's heavy. I always try to take a book because when I'm just trying to relax at the end of the day, it's too easy to start staring at the screen, and then you start looking at all the work emails that you should have been looking at and all of that. And before you know it, you're not enjoying your holiday anymore. So I do always take a book, even if it's going to weigh me down a bit more. I will sometimes try and go pretty light. You know, I try and sometimes have a one pannier holiday in particular. I sometimes travel by folding bike, and the folding bike I have, which is a Bike Friday, travels much more easily if you can just put one pannier on the seat post. And then, yeah, you know, at that point, you're at the absolute minimum of clothes, bike repair stuff, and that's it. You're by definition doing credit card touring, but that's a perfectly valid and perfectly good fun thing to do.
I think, I mean, a pair of shorts and a pair of long trousers for the evenings, a t-shirt or some kind of shirt that you're happy cycling in, maybe two, I don't know, and then something to keep the wind out and perhaps something to keep the rain out, and maybe a change of pants and a change of socks. I mean, one thing that I do that is a luxury, but I am convinced of its value, is a second pair of something to put on your feet. And I've said it like that. It's like something to put on your feet does does cover quite a wide range of options, from, you know, an actual other pair of shoes to a pair of plastic bags and everything in between. Yeah. I think some kind of sandals to wear is nice. I mean, being in the same shoes all day for an extended period of time, especially if you're cycling and your feet are getting a bit hot, is a bit of a pain, and it is a nice feeling to put on something else in the evening.
Definitely. And I think the other thing I'd say is make sure that a bit of rain isn't going to ruin your week, isn't going to make absolutely everything drenched and unable to go anymore. We had a holiday a few years ago in Brittany where it just rained solidly all week, and it was not a whole bunch of fun, to be honest. Lovely cycling in theory, but when you're just solidly drenched, all your clothes are drenched, everything is soaked through in the pannier. No. So I'm now a bit more careful about making sure that what I pack is reasonably quick dry and that I've got the absolute minimum, but still whatever you need in terms of waterproofs.
I don't tend to advocate waterproof trousers for cycling, but I think you're right. Quick dry is the most important, and then something to keep you warm so that even if you do get a bit wet, you're still warm. So so a kind of a waterproof jacket is a good idea. Yeah. And then, yeah, some quick drying shorts, particularly in the summer, because, you know, if your legs are going to stay warm, and then once the sun comes out, you will dry pretty quickly if you're wearing something fairly quick drying on the elsewhere. I mean, feet is the other, that's another reason why having a pair of sandals is good, because if it's pouring with rain, you just put your sandals on and cycle in those.
Yes.
And don't worry about your feet, because shoes, I mean, a pair of padded cycling shoes, you know, once they get absolutely drenched, they can take days to dry out if you've not got a drying room if you're camping. I mean, that's one great thing about youth hostels in general. They've often got drying rooms where you can get everything dried out. So that's a, you know, youth hostels are pretty cycling friendly. I don't know what their situation is for the summer. I'm not sure that they do either. A lot of youth hostels do allow camping in the grounds, although they do charge quite a bit for it now than they used to, almost the same as what they charge for a bed inside. But it does mean you could get access to the drying room and you know, other facilities. The weather, I do look a lot at the weather apps. I have the Met Office app on my phone, which I find to be pretty accurate, and looking at the forecast for the rain for the next 6 hours is quite helpful in terms of planning where you're going to have your breaks. And I will sit out a heavy rain shower. If I can see from the chart that it's something that's going to pass overhead, I will go and visit a 12th century church or have an extended sit inside a cafe if it's raining or wherever. So I don't think there's any harm in ducking out of heavy weather if you can see that it's, you know, only going to last an hour or two.
Likewise, I swear by Dark Sky, which is a wonderful weather app and which I think Apple has just bought because they were so impressed by its predictions. The one thing I would say, though, with the weather is that you duck into a cafe, and that's a very sensible thing to do often when it's heavy rain. But you can convince yourself that it's still heavy rain outside, and actually it isn't. It's just spotting, which can be some of the most enjoyable cycling through very, very light rain. So, you know, sometimes you think, oh yeah, you know, I can't possibly keep going, it's still raining. Once you've got 5 minutes into it, it's okay.
And then mechanical competence. That's something that I think challenges a lot of people. Josie, in my interview, was quite cavalier about it as well. You know, she was like, "Well, I'm just gonna go, and I'm just gonna sort it out as far as I can en route." But some people think, "Well, look, what happens if my bike breaks? What am I gonna do? I'm gonna get stranded. I'm gonna get stuck." What do you think are the main tasks that people should feel comfortable and confident doing, and what tools do they need to be able to do them?
So the 90% issue is always going to be punctures. So I would more than anything recommend that people have good, fairly sturdy tyres, because even something famously sluggish like a Marathon Plus, the extra 10 minutes that it takes you to cycle your miles for the day because you've got a slightly sluggish tyre is more than going to be saved by the time you spend not having punctures. So yeah, get decent, robust tyres. Make sure that you can replace an inner tube. You don't have to be too purist about whether you've mended the puncture or you've just put a new inner tube in it. There's no reason not to do the latter, but make sure you can put that in. Other than that, I mean, there are a million and one little mechanicals that can happen. Weigh up what the chance of them actually happening is if your bike has been reasonably well serviced. One thing that has tripped me up in the past is don't make a long tour your first bike ride after a service, because you might find that, for example, the brakes have been adjusted to something that you weren't expecting, and all of a sudden your bike is stopping in half the distance that that you expected, and you're going over the handlebars. Not that that has ever happened to me in any way, shape or form, but yeah, if you're going to get a service and that's a great thing, then don't go out for your big tour immediately afterwards.
Yeah, that's good advice. I mean, it is good to get a service, but because they may spot things that are on the way out. But it's worth taking spares. I think if you've got disc brakes, it's worth taking a spare set of pads.
Yep.
Because those do wear out quite quickly in certain circumstances. Well, Richard, we've talked for a greater length than we'd intended, but I could talk about this sort of stuff all day.
Likewise.
I should let you go with thanks for the work you do on cycle.travel. It is a brilliant website. I mean, lots of people do use it, lots of people sing its praises, but I think it's something that not enough people know, because it's a one-man band, an artisan product, not backed by lots of venture capital and PR consultancies and all the rest of it. Support your artisan route builder in cycle.travel is what I say. And
thank you.
Yeah, and particularly the route guides. If you're looking for a long distance route for this summer, definitely check out Richard's route guides, because they're the kind of thing that is not what I do in my Lost Lanes books, really, long point-to-point journeys. Having seen your Land's End to John O'Groats route, I really now want to do the end-to-end, and I've not really fancied it in the past. So thank you for that, Richard.
Thank you very much for the talk. It's been great fun.
Well, you've made it through an epic edition of the podcast. I think you can pat yourself on the back. My thanks to Richard and Josie for their time. And to you, dear listener, for sticking with us as Richard and I went down the cycle touring rabbit hole. And if all that planning and preparation sounds way too much trouble, well, you know what? It probably is. And I think all of us could benefit from taking a leaf out of Josie's book and embracing the unplanned and the unpredictable and just letting the cards fall where they do. If you've got thoughts or reactions to what you've heard, or tips and suggestions to share with us and with other listeners, I'd love to hear them. You can post a comment, of course, on the Bike Show website, or tweet me at Jack Thurston, or better still, record a voice memo and send it to me by email. And if we get a few good ones, I'll feature them in a future podcast. The email address is bikeshow@gmail.com. bikeshow@gmail.com. And I'd be particularly interested in any reflections that are specific to this strange situation of the global pandemic and how that has changed your approach to cycle touring. I hope you're keeping well during this very weird moment in history, and whatever your cycling plans are for the summer, I wish you fine weather, good fortune, and lots of fun. Until next time, goodbye.